Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. About 45 minutes ago, the Senate began debating voting rights legislation. Over the past 8 months, Republicans have blocked debate 4 separate times. The debate comes as Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema refuse to support changing filibuster rules. Without changing the rules, Democrats need 60 votes for the bill to pass. But only one Republican, Senator Lisa Murkowski, supports the John Lewis voting rights bill. Not one Republican supports the Freedom to Vote Act. Well, on a party line vote, the House recently combined the two bills into one. It is now called the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act. We called Senator Murkowski's office this morning to find out if she supports the combined bill, but she has yet to make a statement. So here's where we are. Democrats are going to meet this afternoon to once again discuss changing the filibuster, and then a procedural vote on the bill is expected tomorrow. On Thursday, just hours before President Biden was scheduled to meet with Democrats to discuss the bill, Senator Sinema took to the floor to say supporting an exception to the filibuster would, quote, worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country by allowing the laws to pass without bipartisanship. It's important to note that for much of its history, the filibuster was used by a minority of white conservatives to prevent civil rights legislation from becoming law. Here is Martin Luther King Jr. speaking about the filibuster on July 5th, 1963.
I think the tragedy is that we have a Congress with a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster to keep the majority of people from even voting. They won't let the majority of senators vote. And certainly they wouldn't want the majority of people to vote because they know they do not represent the majority of the American people.
That is Martin Luther King Jr. speaking about the filibuster on July 5th, 1963. Study after study shows that voter suppression laws disproportionately harm voters of color. Between January 1st and December 7th of last year, at least 19 states passed 34 laws restricting access to voting, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. More than 440 bills were introduced in 49 states last year. The center says these numbers are extraordinary. And the only way to truly address this is through federal legislation. Well, we have a great panel to talk about what is at stake and what is next. Before we dive in, we want to welcome Brandon Ortega to the show. Brandon is a junior at Arizona State University, and he's part of a group of students who just relaunched a hunger strike that they initially started in December to demand that Congress pass voting rights legislation. Hi, Brandon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, Brandon, tell us a little bit about all of the work that you all have been doing in the last year, canvassing, calling, holding events to demand the passage of voting rights legislation.
Of course. I first joined UNPAC way back in March, and, you know, I worked in Arizona and ASU specifically. And since then, we've, of course, you said we've done everything from calls, emails, canvassing, holding events with state legislature. Even during our last hunger strike, we met with Senator Kelly and Senator Sinema. And all that still hasn't been enough to get this bill across the finish line. And that's why we are here again on a hunger strike.
How long have you been on this hunger strike, and how are you and the others doing?
Yeah, of course, our last hunger strike lasted 15 days. And while our senators went home for holidays, you know, it wouldn't make sense for us to continue out there last time. But now, since they're back in session, and, you know, there's been promises made by our elected leaders in the Senate, as well as from the president, that first thing on the table back in the Senate is voting rights. And of course, MLK Day was yesterday, and voting rights still has not been passed. The Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act still has not passed. So we are here escalating with the hunger strike, even beyond that today.
How are you all doing? I mean, we had hunger strikers on last year who were striking about the climate crisis, and going on a hunger strike really takes a toll on your body.
Yeah, of course, there is hunger pains and, you know, fatigue and just overall discomfort. And personally for me, what was harder than that was, you know, having my mom worried back at home. And, you know, there's similar situations like that among all of us. Our parents were worried. But what would be hard to overcome would be the consequences of a dysfunctional democracy. And that's why we're putting our bodies on the line, because we have almost no future without the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act being passed.
What was your meeting like with Senator Sinema? What did you say to her, and what did she say to all of you?
No, by now we've met with her and her staff about two or three times now. And she told me face to face that some of her biggest heroes were John Lewis and John McCain. And as Arizonan, of course, both of them are my heroes as well. And they were big champions for voting rights and campaign finance. And they did not let anything get in their way. And so if she wants to be remembered as they were, as heroes as they were, it's pretty clear the choice that she has to make. And that's passing the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act.
Brandon, obviously you know what's happening. So many things are changing quickly. Without changing the filibuster rules, there's just no way the Democrats are going to get 60 votes. So what is your strategy going forward if we do not have federal voting rights protections?
You know, of course, we don't have a lot of political power as a people. We can only, you know, organize so much. We don't have money to donate to these partisan senators who really only care about their corporate interests. And, you know, even today, I'm not sure if you guys heard, we had to escalate even further. And some of our circuits were arrested at the Capitol today, and with faith leaders as well, you know, just to show how committed we are to this action. And that's what we're having to do for them to take us seriously.
And I'm sure that you're all under medical supervision.
Yes.
Final thoughts, Brandon. What do you want listeners to know? And what can people do, given how crucial this is and how Democrats are going to meet again this afternoon, East Coast time? I'm sure to try to get Manchin and Sinema to change their minds on the filibuster. So there's not much time here. What can people do?
Yes, of course. We don't have any more time left. This is now or never. So to people across the country, especially my Arizonans, call your senators, you know, make a social media post, tell them to pass the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act. And to our senators, you know, the world is watching, history is watching, and the choice to make is simple and clear. Pass the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act.
Well, Brandon, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back, and we'll definitely be following Unpack on social media.
Thank you.
Thank you. Brandon Ortega is a junior at Arizona State University, and he is part of a group of students there with Unpack, an organization working to fix democracy in the U.S. They spent most of last year calling, canvassing, holding events. They are now on their second hunger strike to demand Congress pass voting rights legislation. Well, joining us for the rest of the hour to talk about what's at stake and where we go from here are three guests. Wanda Mosley is National Field Director for Black Voters Matter, an organization dedicated to expanding Black voter engagement and increasing progressive power. Hi, Wanda. Thanks so much for joining us. Oh, Wanda is going to join us in a couple minutes. We are joined by Bertrall Ross, Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Professor Ross's research is driven by a concern about democratic responsiveness and accountability. Hi, Professor Ross. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Diana Phillip is Chief of Staff at the Democracy Initiative, a coalition of 75 civil rights, gender rights, labor, and environmental organizations with a combined 45 million members. Hi, Diana. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Great to have you. Professor Ross, I want to start off with you. I mean, it's incredible to think that these young people are on their second hunger strike. So much is at stake right now with the debate finally happening. Democrats are going to meet and do their best to try to get Senators Sinema and Manchin to change their mind on the filibuster. What are your thoughts about where we are right now?
Yeah, I want to commend Brandon Ortega and the other members of UNPAC for their courage and their dedication to our democracy. You know, right now we're at a standstill. As you mentioned, Senators Sinema and Manchin have shown no willingness to make any adjustments to the filibuster rule to carve out exceptions for election bills that are designed to protect minority voting rights. Instead, they've decided that protecting a minority of senators' ability to block legislation is more important at this point. And so it's not clear what the path forward is. I do appreciate Senator Schumer introducing the bill and actually going forward with the debate. One thing that's forgotten is that the filibuster is not a voting rule. It's a rule about debates. For debates, you need 60 votes to end a debate. It may be time to think about going back to how we used to employ filibusters in the past, in which you engage, require the senators to engage in a debate, to debate the bill to the point of exhaustion, and then move on to a vote for the bill. Remember, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 endured a 54-day filibuster before it was finally passed into law. And so our democracy is worth it. And it may be time, if Sinema and Manchin are unwilling to make the changes, to debate the bill to the point where it could get a vote.
Diana, what would you add? What are your thoughts about where we are right now?
I think it's incredibly important for the American people to hear this debate, because we need the senators to be on record about where they stand on the freedom to vote. And I want to remind folks that the abuse of the filibuster in the last several years has really decreased the amount of opportunity for robust and authentic debate. There was an article in the Washington Post that talked about how in 2013 and 2014, each year, there were 600 hours of debate on the Senate floor that comprised 55% of the senators' activities on the Senate floor. But in 2021, it was only 136 hours that constituted 12.5 hours of activity. So we know that we're not getting the kind of debate that we deserve, the legislation that is so important to us. So yes, having this debate is going to be incredibly important. We need the senators to step up and say exactly where they stand on this issue.
Well, now I would like to welcome Wanda Mosley to the show, National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. Hi, Wanda. Thank you for joining us. Hi, do we have Wanda?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am here.
Good morning. Hi, thank you, Wanda.
Thank you so much.
So we were just talking about where we are right now. The Senate is finally debating the voting rights legislation, the combined bill, but we still have Democrats, Senators Sinema and Manchin, who say they do not want to change rules for the filibuster. So what are your thoughts about where we are right now?
Well, we are in a very precarious time in this country. This particular legislation that is so desperately needed is not a partisan issue. It is an American issue. It is a democracy issue. And the fact that it even has to be debated is quite telling. I cannot begin to express the frustration that I and so many others feel that this is happening right now. But this is where we are. We are in a time and a place where our most basic right, one of our most sacred rights as Americans, is under attack. And somehow there have been efforts successfully, sadly, to make this a partisan issue. And so we are, you know, in the fight as much as we can be. But it is frustrating that we are at this point in time in the history of our country where, again, our right to vote is something that has to be debated. You know, it's not like we're talking about the right to carry a gun. It's not like we're talking about abortion rights. We are talking about one of the most fundamental rights as American citizens that is guaranteed to each of us in the Constitution of the United States.
Wanda, can you give us your assessment of what happened last week? On Tuesday, President Biden gave the voting rights speech many activists wanted him to give last year. And then Thursday, just hours before he was scheduled to meet with Democrats, Senator Kyrsten Sinema went to the Senate floor to say she opposes changes to the filibuster. What are your thoughts about just what went down last week?
Yes, last week was a roller coaster ride, if you will. On the one hand, we did finally hear the strong speech that we wanted so desperately from President Biden. We think about the speech that he gave in Philadelphia last year that wasn't nearly as strongly worded as the one that he gave in Atlanta. But we did finally get that, only to have that headline overshadowed by the actions of one senator. A senator who, I might add, clearly is probably not listening to the voters in her state, because polling shows that they are in favor of this. You know, I just can't help but ask myself in those moments, man, if only senators Sinema and Manchin worked so hard to protect my right to vote as they do the filibuster, this would be an amazing time for all of us activists and social justice warriors. But, you know, this is where we are. And, you know, this is why also our organization, Black Voters Matter, along with several others throughout the state of Georgia, came out and took the stance that we did not want to attend the event, and that we would rather the president have given that speech to the Senate to really bring home the importance and the need for protection for our voting rights across the country, and in particular in the state of Georgia.
And we'll talk about that a little later in the show, because there's been a lot of criticism of the Biden administration and why this is taking so long. But before we do that, Professor Ross, what are your thoughts about how this is all played out? Biden going to talk to Democrats and then Senator Sinema undercutting that by just making this major announcement saying she opposes the changes to the filibuster.
Yeah, it was quite a surprising move by Senator Sinema. I will say that, you know, in agreement that the Biden speech has come a little late in the fight. This should have been one of the priorities from the very beginning. We knew that the many states, Republican controlled, were passing laws that were designed to suppress the vote from early last year. And so this should have been a priority for the administration, but it didn't seem to be. And with Senator Sinema, I think that since it wasn't made a priority by the president, it almost gave her a cover license, empowered her to act as the obstacle here. We are seeing a weakened president whose approval ratings aren't that great. And, you know, there's seemingly no cost in terms of her sense of partisan support from the executive for her to make that particular speech. But there may be costs that will come forward with respect to the election that she will be subject to soon. I think it just shows that, you know, where Democrats stand and where they're prioritizing voting rights, it doesn't seem to be where they need to be on this particular issue that's critical, not only to the country, but frankly, to their partisan prospects, if you want to think about it in a purely self-interested way. But for some reason, you know, a couple of senators are blinded by, I don't know, the desire to maintain their role as critical, pivotal senators with a filibuster rule in place. I'm not sure.
We have a question from a listener who says, should this bill go down, what are Biden's subsequent executive order options? Diana, do you know?
Unfortunately, no, I do not know. I'm not that schooled in executive orders. I'm wondering if Professor Ross might be.
I mean, they're somewhat limited in terms of what you can impose. If you, you know, look at the Freedom to Vote Act and what it's trying to do, which is to, you know, set minimum days for early voting, allow voters to request to vote by mail, establish online automatic same-day voter registration, make election law a national holiday. Those are actions or provisions that are going to be difficult to enact via executive order. Now, the Constitution gives Congress the authority to set set time, place, and manner of elections, but it doesn't necessarily empower the president to engage in that those acts alone. So I think that there are going to be limited things that the president might be able to do, but it won't be nearly what the Freedom to Vote Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Act are designed to do.
Wanda, what are your thoughts on this? I've heard so many activists over the past year say there's no way we can organize our way out of this.
Yes, you know, it's actually quite frustrating because at some point in time, like now, you would think that self-preservation might kick in with regards to the Senate and who has control over that body. In a lot of ways, I think, gosh, maybe, you know, activists and organizers in Georgia, we were too good at our job and we made it look a little too easy. But it wasn't. You know, this was a whole, at least an entire decade of building infrastructure throughout the state that led us to the results that we got on January 5th, 2021. And so, I don't know, it's a head scratcher, if you will, because I don't understand how it is that the Senate believes they will be able to hold power without these protections that we need, in particular for Black and brown voters in the South.
Well, and it's also important to note that this, like a lot of things, when we look at taking power from the people, has been a long-term project. And Diana, I mean, you've been working on such a variety of issues for over 35 years. And there's a great piece in The Atlantic called How Manchin and Sinema Completed a Conservative Vision by Ron Brownstein. And he points out that Chief Justice John Roberts has basically spent four decades trying to roll back voter rights protections. He writes, Roberts, as much as anyone, set in motion the events that have led to this week's climactic Senate confrontation over voting legislation. In a series of rulings over the past 15 years, the Supreme Court, often in decisions written by Roberts, has consistently weakened federal oversight of voter protections and struck down federal regulations meant to reduce the influence of money in politics. So this has been a long time coming. It's not like this just didn't happen.
I agree. It has been a long time coming. And I think that's why when we look at the importance of national standards, because we knew at some point that the federal courts, the Supreme Court, is not going to help us on this, not this particular court. And so, yes, we should go to Congress and see what we can do to have national standardization. And in order to protect our democracy, this democracy is really being threatened right now. So it has been really upsetting to watch the court make these decisions that's been undermining and not being able to really address the needs of the people. So the idea of this national standardization of all these laws regarding elections, you know, what it does is it provides our voters the confidence to engage again. Because what I'm concerned about is how, after the experience of voting in 2020, that voters won't come back out, right, that they're going to be so confused because the number of state laws that have passed, that some were temporary measures that occurred in 2020 because of the pandemic, and there are states that didn't make those measures permanent. And then we have states, as you said, 19 states that passed 34 restrictions that people really don't know where they're going to stand on voter registration and ballot integrity, early voting, safe voting, and who's going to certify, who's going to have the oversight over our elections. How are people going to be counting my ballot, and how do I know it's going to be certified? So watching this play out, yes, that's why we are so adamant about this opportunity to pass this legislation that we so badly need for this democracy. And it's not just about voting rights too. I mean, when we talk about the filibuster and the way that it's blocking progress of debate that can turn into an actual vote, which should be the majority of the people that we voted into the Senate. We're also talking about all sorts of different measures that are going to improve our lives. And I just feel as if the Senate cannot step up and do the right thing on something so important and sacred to our democracy as voting, I really fear the other legislation that we badly need in climate change and gun control and bodily autonomy and all of that, we won't get that passed.
Diana Phillip is Chief of Staff at the Democracy Initiative, a coalition of 75 civil rights, gender rights, labor, and environmental organizations with a combined 45 million members. Bertrall Ross is Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Wanda Mosley is National Field Director for Black Voters Matter, an organization dedicated to expanding Black voter engagement. Before her current role, Wanda served as Senior State Manager for Black Voters Matter in Georgia. Today, we are discussing voting rights. The Democrats right now, the Senate, I should say, They're debating voting rights legislation. It happened at about 9:15 a.m. Pacific time. Over the past 8 months, Republicans have blocked debate on voting rights 4 separate times. So what's going to happen is they're going to debate voting rights legislation. The Democrats are going to meet this afternoon to once again discuss the filibuster, and then a procedural vote on the bill is expected tomorrow. But without changing the filibuster rules, without support from Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrats, obviously, they just don't have the 60 votes needed for the bill to pass. Not one Republican supports. Well, I shouldn't say that. There is one Republican, Senator Lisa Murkowski, who supports the John Lewis voting bill. Not one Republican supports the Freedom to Vote Act. We called Murkowski's office this morning to see if she supports the combined bill, and she has yet to make a statement. We'll take your questions and your phone calls after a quick break. This is Your Call. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to do a two-part series on the homeless crisis in this country. We'll first discuss California. That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we will talk about what is happening across the country, what is working, and what needs to change. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about voting rights. Without changing the filibuster, the Democrats will not get 60 votes for the bill to pass. Both of the bills have been combined into one. It is now called the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act. And we're talking about this with three guests. Today we're joined by Wanda Mosley, National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. Bertrall Ross is Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. And Diana Phillip is Chief of Staff at the Democracy Initiative. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, what are your thoughts about where we are right now? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Professor Ross, the other thing we need to talk about is that the Atlantic piece brings this up. This all sends a signal to Republican-controlled states that the Supreme Court is unlikely to stand in their way if they impose new restrictions on voting or extreme partisan gerrymandering. And in this piece, Deborah Archer with NYU said, we're going to see a new wave of state legislation that is just as dangerous as what we have seen so far.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And what you're going to see are Republican states not getting any pushback from Congress or the courts, continuing to push the ball and continuing to see where the line ultimately will be drawn with respect to voter restrictions, to the point where you already have right now, through partisan gerrymandering, the most minority-controlled institutions in our society, which are state legislatures, through the drawing of district lines in ways that favor the dominant partisan party in that particular state. And so they've guaranteed themselves majority control for the decade in several states that have drawn districts already. And now they can use that control further to enact voting restrictions to limit the opportunities for those who tend to vote for the other side to vote and to enhance their own ability to continue to win elections and to gain more power for themselves and their party. This is the Republican playbook, and this Republican playbook will continue to be followed until there are any constraints placed on it. And the Supreme Court has, again, shown no interest in the case of Brnovich versus the Democratic National Committee, which involved Arizona voter restrictions. The court not only allowed the voter restrictions to stand, but they also weakened the last remaining important provision of the Voting Rights Act, the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And so, you know, the green light has been given by the court to go forward, and Congress is doing little to stop them.
Wanda, if we can talk about an extreme example of gerrymandering in the state of Georgia, I mean, this is really incredible. Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman has a piece out called The Coming Coup, How Republicans Are Laying the Groundwork to Steal Future Elections. And he writes, a week before the 9th anniversary of her son's murder, Representative Lucy McBath discovered that Republicans had radically redrawn her district to oust her from Congress. A political novice, Lucy McBath had become a leading gun control advocate after her 17-year-old son, Jordan Davis, was shot by a white man in 2012 in an altercation over the volume of rap music he was playing. And we've done several shows about Jordan Davis. The piece goes on to say, Lucy McBath went on to stage one of the biggest electoral upsets in Georgia's history when in 2018, she became the first black person to represent the state's 6th district, Newt Gingrich's home turf for 20 years. They took her out of her own district. I mean, this is just incredible.
Yeah, it is actually quite incredible. I mean, it's not even something that they're trying to hide. They're not trying to use any backdoor measures. It is quite blatant. And they are completely out front with what it is that they are trying to do. They know that they cannot win just having free and fair elections. The only way that they are going to win is to cheat. And they cheat by drawing voters out of district, drawing the people who will support them into a district, and basically guaranteeing themselves, as I stated earlier, another decade of power. And I would just also like to point out that this is not new. During legislative sessions for the past several years, members of the Georgia GOP have introduced new maps during sessions, not waiting until the results from the census to, again, try to blatantly draw people of color out of certain districts where margins are becoming competitive. And this is at the state level that they've done this. So it was not new to us. We were not surprised to see it. But again, we're glad that the rest of the nation is seeing what we have been dealing with in Georgia for the past, maybe I guess 20 years or so, since the Democrats lost control of the state legislature.
So this happened to Lucy McBath in November. So now she has to run in a neighboring district.
Correct. Now she has to run in a neighboring district, which was also held by a Democrat. So essentially, the Democrats have lost a congressional seat in the state of Georgia. In spite of the fact, like Texas, the census has shown that population growth has been driven by people of color. And yet people of color now have less representation. Look, I'm not a legal scholar. I didn't study law. I'm an activist and an organizer. This seems pretty cut and dry to me. It's pretty simple math that we're seeing here. Take, black and brown people out of the equation, add more white people, and Republicans will win. It's a pretty simple formula. And I do hope that the courts take a good look at this. And I hope that there are remedies in the court that will protect us from this.
Well, right. To your point, Lucy McBath's district has been changed. And so now they added 3 deeply red counties to her district. There's no possible way she can win again. Professor Ross, it's incredible that this is legal.
Yeah, it is. And the court had the opportunity a couple years ago to weigh in on partisan gerrymandering to impose some constraints and limits, and they declined the invitation. And they ultimately decided that this is an issue that they can't come up with standards for. And so therefore, we're going to leave it to state legislatures to have discretion to draw districts as they wish, subject to whatever constraints state courts might put on them. And so what we're left with are state courts. But the challenge and the problem with state courts is that many state courts and state judges are elected. And so you have the partisan influence on state judges in many states that may lead them to act or not act with respect to partisan gerrymandering, depending on their partisan orientation and the electoral consequences that might result from them acting or not acting. So it's a real quagmire, and it creates the biggest distortions in our democracy, in which we not only have a minoritarian Senate because of the 2 senators per state, but we also have a minoritarian House of Representatives because of the way that Republican state-controlled legislatures are drawing district lines, and we have minoritarian controlled many states because of the way that Republican state legislatures and even some Democrat state legislatures are drawing state legislative lines. And it's really a very distorting effect on our democracy and creates a lot of quite a bit of dysfunction as well.
Wanda, what effect does this have on voters. I mean, there have been so many great mini documentaries about the incredible work that was done in Georgia, where you would go door to door, spend time talking with people who said, you know, why should I vote? My vote does not matter. It took time. It takes energy. It takes passion to do this work. And so you have people who are newly involved in this process. And then they hear about someone like Lucy McBath, who gets basically has to run in a completely different district. And then they look at all of these laws that are passed to prevent them from voting. What effect does that have on people who are not activists, people who are just trying to get by, you know, feeding their families? They take part in the process and then these rules change.
Yeah, it does create quite a challenge for us. I know for our organization and many of the other nonpartisan 501c3 organizations, we don't so much talk about candidates when we are engaging with voters. We more so discuss issues and how those issues are affecting their everyday lives. And so when we are able to pick those issues, we're somewhat insulated by, you know, what candidates, what politicians do. But to your point, they are hearing about a lot of these voter suppression bills being written and then signed into law. And so it is our hope that we are savvy enough to use that to motivate folks and to remind folks that this is all because of what we did in 2020 and again in 2021, that this is a result of our flexing our collective power and taking control. You know, this wouldn't be happening if we weren't winning. If we were losing, it would be status quo. But this is only happening because we are winning. And so we are charged with continuing the momentum and telling our folks the way to battle this is to continue to flood and overwhelm the system and to continue to vote like our lives depend on it, because they absolutely do.
Professor Ross, you touched on this in a piece you wrote called The For the People Act Would Help Close the Economic Voter Participation Gap. Can you just give us kind of a synopsis of your piece?
Well, one thing that people tend to overlook is that there is a 30% gap between the voter gap between the wealthiest 20% of Americans and the poorest 20% of Americans in terms of turnout. And what that means is that the poor are not only not participating, but they're not being represented in the political process. So who are these barriers to voting targeting? Well, it's targeting those who can afford to pay the cost of voting the least. To the extent that you limit the time to vote, you know, those who are working, just trying to, again, feed their family and to survive on a day-to-day basis, are going to have pay a higher cost in order to vote, since you have less time to vote. If you restrict the ability to vote by mail, you eliminate an important convenience factor that could be critical to low-income communities that may not have the time to go to the polls or wait in the extremely long lines that await them at the polls in order to vote. And so the Freedom to Vote Act, or what was the For the People Act, could ameliorate those effects by opening and creating greater opportunities for ballot access, reducing the cost of voting, and allowing those low-income voters to enter the system in a way that's much more palatable to their time and resource constraints. And in combination with the efforts of voter mobilization groups who can provide them with information about the issues, right? And then for political parties that could provide them a sense of what the candidates stand for, that can provide the additional impetus for these low-income individuals to vote and to reduce that gap, which has caused great disparities in representation as well that are quite harmful for our democracy.
Diana, this is what the Poor People's Campaign has really been working on. They often talk about poor and low-income voters. The 2020 election saw the highest voter turnout among poor and low-income voters. And you have to give the people a reason to vote. I mean, that's one of the arguments that they're making.
Yes, that is very true. And I think that we have to concentrate also on that accessibility and the safety of voting, because the pandemic is raging on. And I think that people have to consider all the different methods of voting. I think that people did really appreciate the mail, vote by mail. And also some of the states that did temporarily take away the excuse for applying for a ballot, but it was just temporary for some of them. So we should be looking at the costs of doing the elections, and also in a way that lowers the cost and the inaccessibility of marginalized and vulnerable populations and what it is that they are challenged when they go to vote. So it's so many different factors that really come into consideration, the totality of circumstances about whether or not voters will come out in November. So it's the, you know, was it easy for me to register? Was it easy for me to go to the polls? Was I able to get my ballot? All of that. But along with the external influences, you know, of hearing people challenge whether or not the elections were going to be fair, and the disinformation campaigns, the political violence that was erupting in that first week of November, it was all affecting people's ability to not to wonder whether or not they should go out and vote. But they did. And it was a record number. And now the concern is for 2022, will we have that same number come out? Or now are we engaged in so much confusion of all the state laws that are passing? And if we don't get the ability to pass this national standardization through this beautiful Voting Rights Act, you know, will voters come out? Will they actually deal with those challenges? Or will they say, you know, I don't think that people really care what my voice is? And it's so sad because vote by mail, that brings so many more people to the table. It's more representative and it's a lower cost for all the states involved.
Diana Phillip is Chief of Staff at the Democracy Initiative. Today we are talking about what's in store for voting rights. Bertrall Ross is Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. Wanda Mosley is National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. Democrats, the Senate is debating voting rights right now as we speak. Democrats are going to gather this afternoon to talk about changing the filibuster to try to encourage Senator Manchin and Sinema to change their minds. And then there will be a procedural vote on the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act tomorrow. Let's hear from a few callers and thank you for being patient. Let's go to Linda in Berkeley. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, did you mean Lena?
Oh, Lena, I'm sorry, yes.
Oh, no, that's okay. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. First, I just wanted to thank the guests for all the work they're doing. And then I guess I have a question around if we're not going to win this fight in the courts and in Congress, if we don't, you know, in a timely way, what do the panelists think about, like, if enough people on the left were engaged in combating these efforts, just with sort of civic engagement around voting, could we retain and even gain more progressive power in government? And sort of like, what does that look like? I'm an artist and I spend a lot of time trying to mobilize people to vote through public art projects and then fundraisers for some of the organizations that are represented today. And I just always think about if we just had more people kind of actively engaged in, you know, maybe just what does that look like and how can we get more people engaged in this fight, and also just sort of putting a plug in for engaging more artists in kind of activating, mobilizing, and exciting people around the cause.
Well, thank you for the call. We should note that while we saw record turnout in 2020, 80 million people still did not vote in the U.S. Diana, do you want to take that one first?
Yes, I think it's a great question, because if this doesn't work and we don't have a national standardization, I think that's what voting rights advocates have been asking one another. What do we do? And that voter outreach is going to be so incredibly important in order for people to understand what their rights are. You know, when you look at a state like Texas that decided that only one ballot box per county should somehow work, and to restrict curbside voting in a way that folks with mobility, disability, pregnancy issues are not going to be able to use it. You know, this is the stuff that voters are going to need to know exactly what their rights are. At the same time, we're going to have to figure out how to create more safety for the people who are working at the polling sites. The state of Maryland right now has legislation pending in order to ban firearms within 100 feet of a polling site. And then Texas, however, decided that they're going to slap a Class A misdemeanor against election officials who want to intervene and protect against voter intimidation of poll workers, giving poll observers more power to actually be associated and be around voters in a way that would be intimidating. And so we need to make sure that voters know exactly what their rights are in every particular state, because every state is so different. So it's the poll workers that we need to protect. We need to educate the voters. And also, if people have the energy and want to engage in that advocacy, we have to figure out how more nonpartisan oversight needs to occur. And there's a lot of state legislatures right now that are trying to pass more partisan oversight that would undermine the election results. So those are the three areas that we really need to look at. If we're not going to have this national standardization, then we're going to have to look at the local level and the statewide level about how each state can do better. And believe me, looking at the statistics, every state can do better.
This is such an important point. Ari Berman with Mother Jones reports that more than 160 Republican candidates who've amplified the big lie are running for statewide positions with authority over how elections are run. Many more election deniers are running for positions like poll worker and election judges. And the Republicans are not being coy about their intentions. Last month, former Trump strategist Steve Bannon called for the overthrow of election clerks, saying, quote, "We're going to take over the election apparatus." So, Professor Ross, there's also that element to add to all of this.
Absolutely. And that those threats of election subversion also have a suppressive effect. When voters think that maybe my vote won't matter because it will be overturned or subverted by partisan elected officials, that deters individuals from voting. And so one of the things that, you know, should be a focus in addition to these two important voter suppression bills are bills to address opportunities for election subversion. We do not want a repeat of 2020. We do not want a repeat of January 6th. And we need to enact a law or amend the Electoral Count Act, which is designed to provide some protections against election subversion to avoid that situation and that particular conflict from occurring again. Now, I think that this is an area where there is perhaps bipartisan support because it does serve the partisan self-interest of Republicans to actually amend the act, because a question and controversy arose around the power of the vice president with respect to the certification process during the last election. How much power does Mike Pence have to, in a sense, overturn the election? Now we have a Democratic vice president, and so Republicans are a little wary. Maybe that Democratic vice president might use power inappropriately. And so they have an interest now in reforming or amending the Electoral Count Act, but we'll see what goes forward.
Well, thank you for that question. Let's go to Ted in Oakland. Hi, Ted. Welcome to the show. And we're almost out of time.
Okay, very quickly, I think it's got to be a two-pronged attack, the law, legislature, but going back to organizing, get now, planning how you're going to get the voters to where they can vote. Think of Martin, you know, that has to be, I think, you know, something that has to get started now in planning and getting commitments and things like that. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Again, so many organizers say it's hard to organize out of this. Wanda, what are your thoughts? And we should note that one of the provisions, the voter suppression provisions in Georgia, was a reduction in the number of drop boxes. And it was felt mostly in Fulton County, which includes Atlanta, where the number was slashed to fewer than 10 from 38.
Yes. You know, with all due respect to the last caller, we are already doing that. We've been doing that. We've never stopped organizing. We organize 365 days a year, not just when there's an election coming. And so this goes back to the statement that was made earlier at the top of the show, that we can't out-organize voter suppression. It is strategic. It is with surgical precision that they decide where to take votes. A few percentages here, a few percentages there, a few drop boxes here, a few drop boxes there. Although in the case of Georgia now, there's been legislation introduced to ban all drop boxes. So there, let's just get rid of all of them, which, you know, I'd like to point out, the use of drop boxes for vote by mail was perfectly fine when it was mainly white voters using it. But when we saw a huge increase from Black voters last year and in 2020, then all of a sudden it's wrought with fraud and all kinds of other issues. You know, this idea that we need to just work a little harder, register a few more people to vote, get a few more voters out, is quite frankly disrespectful and frustrating to hear, because that is literally what we do 365 days a year. So I can't out-organize racism. I can't out-organize white supremacy, which is really what is at the crux of all of these bills that we're seeing signed, which is at the crux of these judges that we're seeing put in place, which is also at the crux of the reason why we don't have a livable wage in this country, although it does affect more than just people of color, quite frankly, because making people wait in line 6, 8, 9 hours to vote is 6, 8, 9 hours that I'm not on the clock making $8, $9, $10 an hour to try to keep food on the table and to try to keep the lights on in my house. So this is all part of a larger strategy that, quite frankly, I'm tired of fighting. And if we were truly a democracy, I wouldn't have to.
Well, and then one aspect we didn't get to today is there's a lot of dark money behind these voter suppression bills, including people from places like the Heritage Foundation, and that deserves far more attention. Well, Wanda, we've had so many people on from Georgia over the last couple years, and we know how hard you all have worked. So thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Wanda Mosley is National Field Director for Black Voters Matter. Before that, she was Senior State Manager for Black Voters Matter in Georgia. Bertrall Ross is Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. You can find his work at yourcallradio.org. Professor Ross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Diana Phillip is chief of staff at the Democracy Initiative. For over 35 years, she's been working to advance civil liberties and human rights. Diana, thank you so much for your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. We will definitely continue to follow this. As we said, the Senate is now debating voting rights legislation. Both of the bills have been combined into one called the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act. Democrats are going to meet later today to, we're assuming, try to convince Senators Manchin and Sinema to change their tune on changing filibuster rules. And then a procedural vote on the bill is expected tomorrow. And we will follow all of this and bring you the latest, probably on Friday. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to start a two-part series on the homeless crisis. We're going to first focus on California, and then we'll talk about the country at large, what is working, and what needs to change. Thanks to Chris Newthy for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.